And joining me on the telephone is Neil Kinkup. Neil Kinkup is a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's an expert on separation of powers with an emphasis on presidential power. He is co-author with Peter Shane and Harold Bruff of the book Separation of Powers Law, Cases, and Materials. Neil Kinkup, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Well, thank you for having me, Mitch.
Good to have you. And it's also my understanding that during the Bill Clinton impeachment, Senate impeachment trial in 1999, you served as counsel to then-Senator Joe Biden. Is this when Joe Biden was a top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, or do all senators have their own counsels pertaining to issues of impeachment?
Well, no, he hired me because he still had a good deal of seniority on the Judiciary Committee and was a real leader in the caucus on a lot of issues relating to the Constitution and constitutional interpretation. So it wasn't typical for senators to hire somebody for the trial.
Yeah, and I remember he was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee at some time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, very good. Well, let me just first ask you then, since you were following closely, obviously, what was happening in 1999, even though it's now 21 years ago, but how would you compare the 99 Senate trial to what we have witnessed so far this time?
Mm-hmm. So I think the House managers are just night and day different today from what they were in 99, right? In 1999, it was sort of in the wake of the Republican takeover of Congress and the Republican Revolution and their very large majorities that they had racked up in the House and the Senate. And the impeachment was, I think, very much more a partisan affair for the managers then than it is now. I know you were talking a bit before the break about Adam Schiff and Adam Schiff not being exactly a reliable lefty. The impeachment managers in 1999 were very much the right wing, and that's who they were pitching their arguments to, and that's where the impeachment itself was coming from. I think this time Adam Schiff and the other House managers have done a much better job of playing it down the middle, and I say that's a better job because that's how impeachment is supposed to work. So, you know, you mentioned before that I worked for Senator Biden, and when I did, when I first went in and met with him about the impeachment, I was really struck. He did not have a position. He didn't regard it as his job to defend Bill Clinton. He regarded it as his job to listen to the evidence and to be governed by where it went. I mean, he was honestly open-minded. And, you know, I don't think the Republicans came from that place or are coming from that place in this impeachment. So, you know, you see a kind of partisanship in the 99 impeachment on part of the House managers that you don't see today. To date, there's been a kind of partisanship on behalf of the Republicans in the Senate that you didn't see among members of the president's own party back in 99.
And that's interesting. I just want to kind of underscore that point. We've heard this before, that senators were much more open, including Democratic senators, during the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton. And we've heard that they were much more open-minded. But here you were on the inside. And, you know, these just aren't, you know, statements of, you know, fondly remembering the past.
Right, right. No, it was honestly the case, and it was very striking to me. It wasn't exactly what I had expected.
Oh, that's interesting. I do want to get into, and what you are, your specialty is separation of powers and presidential power. What is meant by presidential power?
Well, it means the president's power from the Constitution, but really most of the president's powers come from statutes. And so it's interpreting what the law allows the president to do and understanding what the law forbids the president to do.
And so when we talk about presidential power in light of this impeachment trial, are we just talking about what we continually hear about, executive privilege, or is there a bigger understanding of presidential power in this moment pertaining to the impeachment?
Right. I think this moment has the potential to be defining with respect to presidential power. You know, presidential power does not exist in a vacuum. It is one component of a constitutional structure, right? And that structure is the structure of checks and balances. So the president has power, but so does Congress. And the president's assertions of executive privilege and of unilateral authority are contrary to the system of checks and balances, which recognizes that while the president has some power, that power is always subject to checks by Congress. And a lot of the president's actions and his lawyers' arguments tend toward the result that there would be no check on the president's power. And I think one of the ways in which Adam Schiff in particular has been effective, and Hakeem Jeffries has been very good on this point too, I think, is making the point that if what the president did is not impeachable, and if we accept many of the arguments that his defense team is making, then there will be no constraints on the president's power, that he will be above the law. And that is absolutely and fundamentally contrary to how our Constitution means to set up the government.
Do you think that would have ramifications even after the presidency of Donald Trump? Would this set a new precedent, a new standard?
Sure. And remember, last spring, President Trump declared that he was going to defy all the subpoenas. If a president can do that, then how can Congress conduct oversight of a president? And if Donald Trump gets away with that, why would any other president ever take a different position?
So you're right, because there could be another case, right? You can have a scenario, and this could even backfire in the future for Republicans. You can have a Democratic president. The Democratic president does something that irates and maybe is even questionable. I mean, you know, you can abuse power regardless of what your political affiliation is. And Republicans may believe that a future Democratic president is abusing her or his power. And they try the process of impeachment. And you could have, and I could see a Democratic president using these same tactics and even being justifying it by saying, well, we're just doing the same thing you did in the last impeachment.
Right. No, if you think back to President Obama's term, right toward the end, there was all of the controversy around the Benghazi incident. President Obama could have, if with this Trump precedent, could have said to Congress, I'm not allowing anyone to testify and I'm not giving you any documents.
Did Obama and the Obama administration give all the documents that Republicans wanted in that Benghazi investigation and provided the witnesses they wanted?
I don't know that they provided absolutely everything,
yeah,
but they provided an awful lot, right? I wouldn't claim that executive privilege is never legitimate. There are legitimate reasons that presidents keep some things secret. But the Benghazi investigation, the administration turned over vast troves of documents and sent Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, up to testify for hours on end.
Right? Yeah, it was 14 hours or something.
Yeah, 13 or 14 hours in one day. Can you imagine Donald Trump allowing Mike Pompeo to do that?
Yeah.
Right? No. It wouldn't happen.
I couldn't even imagine it for an hour. Never mind.
Right.
12 to 13 hours. What exactly is executive privilege and what does that mean?
So executive privilege is really kind of a group of different privileges. So some of what we might call executive privilege would relate to military matters. So when the president gives orders to troops, those are understood to be privileged and no one gets access to those. Those are absolutely privileged. Or state secrets. So, you know, nuclear codes and the designs of nuclear weapons and other weapons. Those are absolutely privileged. Diplomatic communications are generally privileged. Right? Now, presidents also claim something that's referred to as a general communications privilege, that all advice that they receive is privileged. And the Supreme Court, in the case regarding the Watergate tapes, accepted that, but said that privilege is a qualified privilege. It's not absolute. And so while the president has a presumptive privilege for all of his communications, that privilege can be overcome if the body seeking the information has an overwhelming need for it. right, if that need is weightier. So in the Watergate tapes case, the Supreme Court said that President Nixon had to turn over his Oval Office tapes in response to a subpoena issued by a court in the context of a criminal proceeding. Congress has a very strong interest in all of these investigations into President Trump, right, and particularly those relating to impeachment. During the George Washington administration, Congress sought documents that President Washington regarded as privileged. His cabinet deliberated on the question, and they agreed with Washington, but they all agreed with the caveat that if there were an impeachment proceeding, then President Washington would have to turn those documents over.
That's interesting, because I've heard George Washington's name used a lot by those who are defending executive privilege in this in mm-hmm. today's Senate trial. But what you don't hear as often is the caveat that you just pointed out.
Right, and it's a crucially important caveat. So, yes, executive privilege is a thing. It's a legitimate privilege, but it doesn't overcome all demands for information, and that's the important point to keep in mind.
I was watching Fox News this morning. I was getting ready to come into the radio station, and I saw White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham on there, and I think that's the only place, one of the few places she actually goes on to speak to the press. And, of course, there are no more White House briefings anymore for the press. And she was making the argument, and just sort of following up on what Donald Trump has already said, making the argument, we would love for all of these witnesses to be able to testify in this Senate trial, but we can't allow that to happen because we must protect the office and protect, you know, the standard of executive privilege.
Right, that's the claim they keep making. I can't imagine anyone actually believes that that's what they think. I mean, it's just not credible. You know, and I don't mean that as an attack, kind of a personal attack on the president or this administration. Yeah, administrations, starting with George Washington, have turned over documents that are privileged, but that they thought Congress should receive. And it doesn't in any way undermine the existence of the privilege. So they don't have to assert it sort of to the hilt in order to safeguard it for future administrations. If that were really their goal, they don't need to do it. And, I mean, let's be honest, it's not their goal. They're not turning over information because clearly it would be incriminating. If it were exculpatory, you know they would turn it over.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. You mentioned the Watergate Supreme Court case in which President Nixon was ordered to hand over his tapes from his Oval Office conversations, I think, to the special prosecutor. Does that have any bearing today in this issue concerning presidential power, executive privilege, and trying to get witnesses to testify or to get additional documents from the administration?
Right. Well, it does, but the administration's argument is that involved a subpoena issued by a court in the context of a criminal proceeding, and so it doesn't bind anybody in the context of a congressional subpoena for an impeachment inquiry or for any of the other oversight matters that Congress has sought documents for. That's the administration's position. I don't think that position is right as a matter of law, but it's a distinction that they can and do draw.
What do you think is the correct position?
Well, I think the correct position is that Congress obviously has a fundamental interest in receiving all of the evidence that's relevant to their impeachment inquiry. And so the president's executive privilege is outweighed by Congress's interest in receiving this information. So, you know, it's a qualified privilege, as the court said in the Watergate tapes case, and the balance in this case clearly favors Congress, as George Washington's cabinet recognized, and as, you know, Congress's ever since have recognized and argued.
I want to talk to you about the dynamics of potentially having John Bolton testify in the Senate trial. Now, John Bolton was former National Security Advisor. This is one of the closest positions to the presidency, probably second maybe only to the, I would argue, the Chief of Staff, the White House Chief mm-hmm. of Staff. courts, the Supreme Court, I believe even, has ruled over the years that when we talk about executive privilege, that privilege is at its highest legal standing when it comes to issues of national security. Now, John Bolton, again, former national security advisor, if he was subpoenaed in this trial to testify, we fully anticipate that Donald Trump would try to block that testimony by the claim, if this is not this claim, you'll correct me, of executive privilege with John Bolton. Of course, John Bolton is no longer an employee of the U.S. government, no longer a member, no longer the national security advisor. He's now just a citizen. Can the president, just generally speaking, invoke executive privilege for concerning national security on somebody who no longer is part of the government? And then B, how do you think this plays out?
So with respect to the first part, the fact that he's no longer employed within the government, I think doesn't matter. Because what Congress is seeking is his testimony regarding his time as National Security Advisor. So the fact that he doesn't hold that title anymore really doesn't matter. The courts have also been clear that the privilege...
But does it matter for the president? Can the president invoke executive privilege now that he is no longer part of the government?
The president can. Right. So it's the president's privilege, and the president is still president. And so the fact that John Bolton isn't any longer in the government doesn't matter. The advice he got from John Bolton is what's being held is what we would regard as confidential.
So that still matters.
And so the fact is he was National Security Advisor when he gave the advice. And so there would be privilege relating to that. But, you know, again, I think it's important to be careful that it is not a categorical privilege. And so there may be particular questions that Bolton can't answer because of some category of privilege. But it is not the case that he is categorically privileged, right? That it's unqualified or absolute. That's just not true. And, you know, it's also true within the area of privilege law that the president's closest advisors are witnesses whose testimony courts are reluctant to force. And I say reluctant, right? Not completely unwilling. And so it's important to the court that Congress or a court, depending on who's issuing the subpoena, have sought the information somewhere else. And it's only if there's no other source for the information that a court would uphold a subpoena. And so in the context of Bolton, you know, a lot of the information that he might testify to, Congress has gotten from Fiona Hill and Alexander Vindman and others who testified. But the president's defense has been none of them were on the phone call, right? None of them had first knowledge or conversation with the president. What they were testifying to was secondhand. And so in relation to that particular defense, John Bolton is the only firsthand source for much of this information, in which case Congress's impeachment need now overcomes the president's interest in keeping it confidential.
This is live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. I'm Mitch Jezrich in the studios of KPFA, and you are listening to this broadcast on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and 90.7 FM KPFK in Los Angeles. We are speaking during this, again, 15-minute break, which is now stretching into 30 minutes, as I anticipated, by Neil Kinkup, who's professor of law at the Georgia State University College of Law. He's an expert on separation of powers with an emphasis on presidential power. He is the co-author, along with Peter Shane and Harold Bruff, of the book called Separation of Powers Law, Cases and Materials. I want to ask you and talk through a little bit this issue. You know, I think when the Senate next week gets to the point of voting on witnesses and potentially additional evidence, if they are to actually say that we are going to have witnesses and additional evidence, it can open a whole new phase. It can open a whole new phase, a whole new dynamic in this Senate trial. And if Donald Trump were to use executive privilege and continue to stonewall investigations by not allowing the witnesses to come testify and not handing over the documents that the Senate may be asking for, sets up a really interesting dynamic. If then the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, seems to back the Republican president in this dynamic, is suddenly then compelled to have to go to the courts to try to get this information from the White House. I mean, it just sort of seems like a new dynamic that could, you know, who knows what happens after that point.
Right. Well, and I think it also would go a long way to substantiating the second article, right, that the president should be impeached by for obstructing Congress. If the president won't cooperate even with an impeachment inquiry, won't turn over evidence relating to that, well, then how can the Senate perform its job? Right, it is a constitutional affront. It is to the Senate. It undermines fundamental constitutional procedures, and so at some point the Senate has to stand up for itself.
That's interesting. You're right. It really does show why you have a second article of impeachment if a Republican-led Senate has to go to court to try to get this information and witnesses freed up to testify and to get that information. Is this settled law? Have we ever had a situation like this in which, I mean, I know courts have had to decide decisions before about executive privilege and access to documents, but, you know, I mean, look, it's only a third Senate impeachment trial that we've had of a sitting president. Do we have case law that already exists to help determine the outcome of this, or is this going to entirely be unprecedented?
It is largely unprecedented. So there are no court cases relating to the impeachment of Bill Clinton or Andrew Johnson. So we really are on a blank slate here. The Supreme Court did decide a case relating to the impeachment of a judge. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that the particular issue, and it had to do with an objection to the Senate's procedure, the Supreme Court said that that was a political question and it wouldn't answer it. That the question relating to the Senate's procedures was committed entirely to the Senate and they could do whatever they wanted to do. It was not reviewable in court. That precedent could be taken to say that if President Trump refuses to turn over documents or to make witnesses available, that's not a justiciable question. A court won't answer it.
Because of the separation of powers.
Because it's committed exclusively to the House and the Senate. The powers of impeachment are there. And in the opinion on the judicial impeachment, a judge who confusingly was named Nixon, but he's not that Nixon. In the course of the opinion, the Supreme Court gave as one of its reasons for regarding that matter as not justiciable, as being, imagine if this were an impeachment of a president, right? It's one thing when it's a judge, but when it's the president, we only have one president. And so impeachment questions relating to the president are particularly difficult and inappropriate for the courts, because the consequence is you leave the question of who is validly the president in the air while the court is litigating. Now, questions relating to documents and evidence don't have that consequence. But the court in that case indicated a very strong reluctance to get involved.
It's kind of like a catch-22 right now, then, isn't it? If the court were to say this is something to be determined between the executive branch and the congressional branch, and if the congressional branch thinks that the executive branch is out of line for not cooperating with documents, witnesses, whatever it may be, then you have the option, if you want to use it, of impeachment. But we're already in impeachment.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it shows a problem with the separation of powers, with the system of checks and balances, right? So Madison, as he described the Constitution, right, he was one of the principal drafters and advocates for ratifying the Constitution. And as he described it, each of the branches was supposed to be ambitious, seeking to expand its power. And the idea of the system of checks and balances is that that ambition would counteract ambition. So the president's ambition would counteract Congress's and vice versa. But are we coming back to...
Well, I'll let you finish your statement, and then we'll have to go back to the...
Sure. So the idea then would be that, yes, the Senate would impeach and convict. But because the Senate is... Well, because members of the Senate are members of the president's party, their interest isn't just to aggrandize the Senate's power, it's to aggrandize the president's, because what's good for him is good for the party and good for their own reelection. And so they don't end up having the same incentives that Madison thought they would. And it's a real problem with checks and balances. And this impeachment, if Republicans stick with the president, has the potential to do really long-lasting damage to that system of checks and balances.
Neil Kinkoff has been our guest. He's a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's an expert on separation of powers, which he has joined us to talk about. He is the co-author of the book Separation of Powers, Law, Cases, and Materials. Neil Kinkoff, that was very helpful. I hope we get a chance to speak to you some more as this trial continues over the days and weeks. But thank you for your time.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I'd love to talk again.
Great.